Hi, Charisse here with a special announcement. You can now enjoy select episodes of Detailed in video form. That's right. Detailed is now available on RCAT's YouTube channel. Now, you may be thinking, I already listened to the podcast. No need to watch it on YouTube. Well, trust me, if you don't want to miss out, even if you're an avid listener of the podcast, the video format is a completely different experience. Not only is it like hanging out with us, but you also get to hear parts of the conversation that were left on the cutting room floor. You can also see the photos, drawings, and video as we discuss the incredible projects that are featured. Come join us on YouTube. Follow the link in our show notes, and let's get into the details. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
If you've ever been to a production mill, they take a log and they analyze it and they say, based off of the shape of this log, I can get these boards out of it. And they get, you know, 3 2x8s. And 2 2x6s and 2 2x4s out of it or something like that based off of the ideal configuration. And that desk is kind of an idealized abstraction of that idea of cutting up this log into small pieces. And so we did that and then we exploded it and we lit it with a light. And it is a really beautiful moment in the building to see that. And I think it's really fitting in character with the overall concept as well.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Bobby Larson, senior associate at DLR Group in Chicago. DLR has, at my count from their website, 33 offices all over the United States, and including one in Dubai and one in Shanghai. Practicing from the DLR Group's Chicago office, Bobby is an architect with a passion for community. He finds it rewarding to have a role that can physically and tangibly influence the spaces and places we live, work, and play. While Bobby specializes in hospitality and workplace environments, he also champions cutting-edge sustainable solutions and leverages his experience in mass timber office building design to apply new ideas to hospitality projects. Bobby views environmentally responsible design as doing more with less, and that the best design overlaps the three pillars of sustainable design: economic viability, social equity, and environmental responsibility. The project we will be talking about today is the T3 ATX East Side in Austin, Texas. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Developed in collaboration with DLR Group and Heinz, the T3 ATX building in East Austin reflects the evolving landscape of the area. Their goal for the project involved repurposing a previously unused space, once occupied by a metal recycling company, into a modern architectural gem.
So Heinz, as a developer, was looking to build some speculative for lease office space in the Plaza Saltillo district of East Austin. Surprisingly, they didn't have as much of a presence in Austin just yet. And so they needed to establish their office there and and build a building that was going to be able to differentiate itself from the other office product available. There's a lot of people moving to Austin right now. And back when we were starting the project a couple years ago, that was also true. And they had acquired a piece of dirt and wanted to maximize the value of it. Hines also has a lot of goals as an organization in terms of sustainability. And we also were pursuing various sustainable metrics to make sure that we met those goals for the company as well.
To fully understand the breadth and scope of this project, Bobby illuminates how this mass timber structure differs from others and what denotes a T3 building.
I think a lot of people have seen mass timber in the news a lot, and I've seen a lot of projects, beautiful projects that use this exposed timber structure. But about 10 years ago, when we collaborated with our client Hines on the first T3, it wasn't very predominant. At that point, the Bullet Center had been built, but there wasn't a lot of invested interest in building new timber buildings. There's a lot of old ones, really beautiful old buildings, and a lot of great, you know, remodels have been done for loft spaces and things like that. And that was kind of the genesis of it. So our client Hines, there was one of their development directors out of this area, was observing some tendencies in their market in Minneapolis. And they had an old loft building, one that was built as, you know, some kind of manufacturing building or something like that, with brick bearing walls on the exterior and timber columns and decking on the interior, designed to be fairly open. And they had repurposed it to become office space. And this particular office space was one of the buildings that had the fastest leasing velocity, which means that tenants would come in, and if they had a vacancy, it'd fill up very quickly. But it also had some of the highest turnover. And so people would walk into this old building and they'd fall in love with the exposed timber and the exposed wood, but they'd be there for a year or two and they'd realize, oh man, these elevators are really slow. The building is drafty. It's really hard when we do our fit outs to have the appropriate routing for conduits and things like that. So this guy, Steve Luthman, he decided, you know, why don't we build a new timber building and why don't we fix all those problems? And so they came up with the idea to build this new timber building, and where it was located just happened to be close to some transit. So the main principles of the project for T3 was to, you know, locate it in areas that are really accessible by rail or by bus or some way. And that's kind of held pretty true. Most of our T3s are near some rail stop, build it out of timber, and address all the technology issues that exist in these really great historic buildings. But me living my 1880 home, I understand some of the issues that are caused by trying to marry modern lifestyles with the old way that we used to build things.
Designed as a mixed-use building accommodating both office spaces and apartments, the project's focus was on optimizing the site's potential and capitalizing on the momentum of a burgeoning neighborhood characterized by a youthful demographic surge.
So the predominant program for the building is open office for lease space. And so the basic configuration of this building, similar to many other offices, is that there is a primary core where the services are located in the stairs. And then there's, you know, a lease span out from that core of open space that tenants will come in and do their fit outs within. And the programming and vision for the building was to really maximize the availability of the site. So there was a set FAR that we were targeting, and we even exceeded a little bit by doing, you know, a little bit of incentives on the project. And we had, you know, so much area on the site, and we ended up using almost all of it to put our building there, which was good for various reasons. It was very efficient for the owner's pro forma, but it also, you know, helped create, you know, a good urban street front around all four edges of the building. Another interesting part of this project, though, was that as part of the entitlements to the site, the city also wanted the project to include a certain number of apartments. If you've ever looked for an apartment in Austin or a house in Austin, you'll find that the market is pretty hot. And so the city was looking for ways to incentivize or set requirements for additional housing. And certain areas. And that was part of the the entitlements process of the site, was to figure out how to include those housing units as part of the overall development.
Early on, DLR encountered a significant obstacle in establishing the site and prioritized a solid foundation to accommodate parking while addressing groundwater mitigation and ensuring effective drainage.
The way that we approach a lot of these projects is that there's typical requirements for office lease spans, and there's also requirements for parking. I don't know, maybe you've heard the phrase before, form follows parking. But whenever you're doing like a building over parking, it dictates a lot of things. And the dimensions of the site just kind of worked out in such a way that if we started at our property line and we measured back the distance required for our shoring and our blindside waterproofing, you know, that's where we set our foundation wall. And so we just kind of like started on the outside, came in, and worked our way up from there. But that worked out pretty closely to having a very efficient parking layout below and an office layout above. But given that it's three stories below grade parking, we also had to worry about a lot of the groundwater and the dewatering process. And so we had to make sure that our foundation was designed appropriately to keep all that water out and then include various large sump pumps so that the groundwater around the building can be cleared out over time. And when the building foundation was finished, like during construction, they had to just constantly be pumping the water because they had a big muddy hole. And the contractors actually had a big party on the day that they got out of the mud because they were so deep down in the ground and there was just constantly water coming in. But they had laid those foundations on all four sides and they set up their pumping and they got all the mud hogged out with their excavators. And it's interesting to watch because the way that they accessed the big pit is they had this big mud ramp that they drove in and out of too. And so they had this big mud ramp that they drove in and out of, got the water out. They drove their equipment out the ramp. They pulled the ramp out and they got it all dried in, and they had to run the sumps continuously for a long time. I don't know exactly how it was, but it was several months before the water table started to recede around the pit, and it finally kind of worked out. Now they only have issues when there's big rains, but it's working the way it was designed to, which is something that you need to do when you go under the ground like that. And the site itself, you know, has a lot of requirements in terms of managing the stormwater runoff, to where we don't necessarily from our own site have to worry about the rise in the water table. You know, we can't control what happens offsite. And so I'm sure that there's times when the water table rises based off of what's happening around us, and that sump kicks back on. So the pump is permanent, and whenever it detects water, it kicks on and it pumps it out and it pumps it up to the city stormwater collection. But the building itself has a pretty extensive management system. There's a couple little swales on the site for stormwater management. And then there's a big like retention tank. So in our parking garage, we have slope parking, and end of our parking garage underneath the slope is this big retention tank. And so anytime there's a big storm, it fills up the tank, and that tank slowly empties into the stormwater system so that it doesn't put a huge load right off the bat into the stormwater system. And that tank is designed to manage the 100-year storm or something like that. So that's part of what is keeping the whole building garage from getting flooded at all. But there's also, you know, various little landscaping and swell opportunities for the service too that help to minimize that.
T3ATX pays homage to Texas heritage by blending metal and wood elements, showcasing craftsmanship and technological innovation. The material palette combines industrial elements like timber and steel with terracotta brick, connecting the building to its surroundings while embracing contemporary design principles.
So our building design was really inspired by the context of the neighborhood that is around us and even the site that we built it on. And so there's a recycling center just a couple blocks away called the Austin Steel and Iron Co. And before our building was there, the site was being utilized as just a big storage yard for scrap metal. And there's a couple of buildings adjacent to it that look like they just raided the scrap metal site and built them. There's this little Pedigab place just to the east of our building, and it's got a ton of character. It is really fitting in this neighborhood. It's really fun neighborhood, but it's all this corrugated metal. And to the northeast, there's a little coffee shop. The Pedigab place isn't so nice, but it has a lot of character. The coffee shop just to the northeast of us, kitty corner to my site, it was really well done. They did it in a way where it didn't look like it was just cobbled together, but they used recycled material in the interim production of it. And so that's one of the things that inspired us on the site, was to kind of use some of these, not necessarily the materials you would consider as, at least from Chicago. In Chicago, when we're talking about Class A office space, we're looking at, you know, buildings that have marble exteriors and things like that. In this location, we used not recycled corrugated metal, but we use some kind of grittier materials on the project. So that was one of our goals, was to kind of tie into this material nature. And we used some of these metals that we were inspired by. And then another thing that we're really driven by on these timber buildings is to make sure that you perceive that they're timber buildings. And that isn't as straightforward as it sounds all the time, because normally it's best in a timber building to keep the wood on the inside so that it isn't exposed to the weathering on the outside. And if you're building an energy efficient building, you frequently have to tint the glass to the point where you don't really see the inside very well as you're walking down the street during the day. At night, when it's lit up on site inside, you can really see the wood on the inside. But we wanted people to be able to perceive that a little bit. So on the exterior, we created locations where there's outdoor space, where there's exposed structure underneath a sheltering element. And because it's sheltered, we feel like it's protected enough that we don't have to worry about it too much. But in doing so, one thing about timber that I think there might be some mixed opinions on is that it's not going to look the same forever. If you have an exposed timber structure on the outside, it's going to, even though it's not rotting, it's going to turn gray. It's the sunlight that does that. The UV from the sun makes your really kind of blondish colored wood slowly turn gray. And we decided we wanted to lean into that a little bit rather than being scared by that. You know, some people might say, oh, well, then you need to sand it and refinish it every 3 or 4 years so that the building looks brand new all the time. But really, we really like the idea of how the fact that the wood would turn gray might help it fit in with this, the neighborhood just a little bit better and not look like the flashy new building all the time, but start to seem like it is aging just a little bit with that patina on the wood. And so in addition to the exterior structure that we tried to carefully expose in key locations, we ended up using a natural wood siding. So it won't just be at the structure that starts to turn gray a little bit. It'll be on some of the predominant facades. There's a little highlight of wood siding. And so in that way, we're kind of hoping that even though we're the new kid on the block, that we'll start to fit in after a short amount of time.
Multiple balconies were employed to connect the office and residential areas, while ground floor apartments were complemented by petite patios.
For the office floor plate, there's a balcony on either end. There's one on the east side and there's one on the west side. And the west side is at a predominant corner that faces the downtown. And it's a notch into the building. It's covered by the roof. And so building's fairly rectangular, and we just took a corner out. And instead of being enclosed, it's exposed. So that's one of the outdoor spaces. And there's building's three stories, and there's a balcony on levels 2 and 3. Similarly, on the east side. And on that one, we positioned it to kind of separate the office space from the residential space on that facade. So on the northeast corner of the site is our main entrance, and it has a little bit of a grander scale to it. And then when you transition from the office facade to the residential facade, what breaks it is that balcony where we're exposing some of the exterior structure. And then some of the apartments also have these little patios. So the apartments, they weren't driving the pro forma for the project. And so we didn't build really, you know, generous apartment spaces. We designed very efficient style apartments. And even though they were already kind of economized down in scale a little bit. And we all decided that it'd be best on the ground floor to shrink it down just a bit more and provide us a small patio between the sidewalk and the street and the ground floor apartments. So there's a few small patios as well.
Currently, the building is exclusively designated for residential and office use, although potential adaptations may be considered in the future.
It is strictly office and apartments, but if there was a potential retail tenant that wanted to take portions of the ground floor, that could be an option. Generally, for retail tenants, we provide additional stuff in the building to make those viable. Generally, retail tenants want a little bit higher floor-to-floor height than your basic office layout. But depending on who it is that goes in the building, we try to very carefully control the finished floor elevation of the building so that you could get an entrance along the west facade and the north facade. And it was a pretty flat site, so it worked out pretty well. That was pretty tricky, though, was trying to really optimize the where the building is located in terms of its elevation to allow for accessible entrances at the main entrance that didn't require stairs, potential for future entrances on other facades. And then at those patios that I was just talking about, we wanted there to be just a really small separation between the patio and the and kind of walking out into the street. And so there's just one step as you step off the patio to get out into the public realm. And so we balanced all that with the ramping requirements of the parking as you come through the alley in the back. And that took a lot of thought and consideration to make sure we got that all worked out.
Upon arrival, visitors are greeted by a reception area that subtly nods to timber structures, creating a warm and inviting atmosphere. Inside, the building offers a versatile environment with movable doors transforming spaces for different purposes. Local artisans contributed to the interior design, adding unique touches that reflect the neighborhood's character.
You know, part of the concept of this building is that it's appealing to a little bit of a different crowd. You know, it's not people who are in the downtown towers. It's people who are looking for smaller scale, more low rise kind of neighborhoods. And timber is limited in how high and how big it can be built. And so it doesn't really make sense to build it downtown where you have to have a 30-story building in order to justify the cost of the land. It really does fit better into these fringe districts that are getting redeveloped and are kind of the cool new place. Instead of a really formal lobby that you'd see in a big tower or something like that, there's kind of a trend in office design where things are becoming more hospitality focused. And so the lobby of your office building is starting to look more like a hotel lobby than it is, you know, the security desk and the turnstile. And it's a place you want to hang out, not necessarily just be impressed as you're walking through. But we have open office floors that people will be able to, you know, do whatever they want with when they rent the space. And I just want to say something about that, though. You know, in terms of the benefit of the timber, if you are shopping around for office space and you're touring typical buildings and it's empty, brand new building, you know, you walk out onto those floor plates and it takes a lot of imagination to think about what your space is going to be and turning that space into a nice space. Because if it's a steel building, you're looking up at fireproof beams and corrugated deck. And if it's a concrete building, you're looking up at some pretty poorly formed underside of a concrete slab. It's kind of a cold space. But when you walk out into these big open timber floor spaces, you kind of feel the warmth and the natural beauty of those spaces. And I think that's why people gravitate toward them and why Heinz has had that success with filling up their buildings faster. It's just that initial impression as you walk into there. But similarly, you know, we're really hoping that people feel that same way with the apartments as they go and see the exposed timber decks on the ceiling and columns. It has a much more homey feel, less institutional than a large concrete or steel building does. And as we're designing the interior finishes for that, we have to really take that into account. So a lot of the finishes that people use today are manufactured finishes. You know, there's a lot of printed finishes. There's a lot of whatever chemical thing, whatever that they mix up, and it turns into something. And the wood is so natural, and it has, there's no repetitive pattern, and particularly the structural wood. Like if you have a really nice table that's made out of some carefully chosen and cut boards, you know, the grain is pretty consistent. But the structural timbers, they use, you know, builder grade lumber, and they scab all the boards together to make glue lams and CLT and DLT panels. And some of the boards are from beetle kill wood, and they're a little bit different color, and they're a little bit streaky. And so it's a very, very natural kind of inconsistent pattern and coloring across all the wood. And so that contrasts even more with something that looks really, you know, super clean. And so when we're designing the interior, we have to think about that effect as well, similar to what we did on the exterior. We try to use a lot of natural materials on the interior too. So we use leathers, or we use blackened steel, materials that have really good natural textures and colors with a lot of good variegation. And we have this really interesting feature stair that on the walls we used brick. Brick's got a really great natural texture and pattern to it. And even though the bricks are all the same size, they all look just a little bit different from one another. And that is really fitting with the timber structure that is accented by all that stuff around it.
A striking feature in the reception area that captivates visitors is a massive illuminated timber desk.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful desk, and we worked really hard to make it happen. It was a concept that our interior designer introduced, and mass timber, by definition, is big wood panels made from small wood. That's the difference between calling something mass timber and heavy timber. Heavy timber is a solid piece of wood. And we can't build with heavy timber anymore because there's not tons of old growth forest that we can go cut down and get 2-foot deep beams out of anymore. So we have, you know, forested lands that the trees grow for 15 years and then they get cut down and they get sliced into smaller boards, and then those boards get laid up into larger pieces of wood. And so if you've ever been to a production mill, they take a log and they analyze it, and they say, based off of the shape of this log, I can get these boards out of it. And they get, you know, 3 2x8s, 2 2x6s, and 2 2x4s out of it, or something like that, based off of the ideal configuration. And that desk is kind of an idealized abstraction of that idea of cutting up this log into small pieces. And so we did that, and then we exploded it, and we lit it with a light. And it is a really beautiful moment in the building to see that. And I think it's really fitting in character with the overall concept as well.
Another component of the interior design is the methodical approach and coordination of the exposed piping, ductwork, and conduit runs, in addition to the wood beams of the structure.
You need to take special consideration for the MEP systems. And a big reason for that isn't just that people want to see the wood, it's that in a lot of cases, it's necessary. The original timber code said that you couldn't have concealed spaces, since concealed spaces were prohibited. And so you couldn't have a full ceiling in a room. You have at least portions of it that opened up to the timber above. The language has been updated a little bit in the later versions of the code, but there's still the kind of this legacy of why would you want to cover the timber? Because it looks nice. But you can make the MEP systems look pretty good, but you want to make sure that they have kind of a thought and system to the design. And the first thing that we always look at is we look at how do we lay out the structure in a way that we can minimize crossings. So you don't want a really big duct going underneath a deep beam. That's kind of the situation that you want to avoid at all costs, because those are the two biggest things that are going to run into each other. And concrete buildings, they are really strong in both directions, and it's really easy to not have any beams at all. And so you just have your ducts all the way to the other side of the concrete deck, and you don't worry about it. And there's ways to frame timber buildings like that too, but to date, they've had really short spans. And so, and to make sure that we get structural spans that we need, we always have to have a few beams or purlins into it. And so we try to make sure that as we're laying out the MEP systems, that anything that happens low happens in a good spot. So we do that kind of up against the core of these office buildings. We run like our main runs near the core. And then we want to make sure that we have a somewhat direct path out to the exterior. And so a few timber buildings like ours have implemented what we call a one-way beam system. So from the core, all the beams run one direction. And so you don't need to cross a beam as you go out to the perimeter. So that's one example of kind of designing your structure in a way to account for that. And there's other projects that have done other things as well. So there's some projects that have done like a stacked beam approach where they have one beam on top of the other, which leaves a gap, and they'll run their MEP through that gap. There's a lot of different approaches to it. So you consider that. And other things that we consider too, and I'm very grateful to the quality MEP engineers that we have, is specifying the MEP is really important, because there's a lot of different ways that you can hang duct, and not all of them look as good. And so there's some language in our specs about the types of hangers that they use that we've kind of troubleshooted in the past with our partners that have been really helpful. You want to do things like use internally lined duct, because the duct insulation looks pretty crude. And so if you have a nice metal finish on your duct because it's internally lined, that looks a lot better. And then it's good to meet with the contractors and make sure they understand things as well. If you've ever seen conduit runs, so electricians, they love to run in straight lines because it's less conduit, less wire. And if you have, you know, a nice regular grid and you have an electrician trying to get to something and he runs, you know, in a straight diagonal line out to it, that doesn't look as clean as like trying to consolidate your conduit runs into one spot and then trying to branch off from a group of them, even though it does taste like less conduit and wire if you kind of just crisscross and go on diagonal paths. And so things like that, you've got to get to an understanding with your engineers and their specifications, as well as with your contractors in the coordination of those trades, making sure that those requirements are understood and implemented on a project.
The T3 building model is new to most cities, so the lack of familiarity with the concept proved to be a challenge when obtaining approvals.
So, you know, over the course of the last 10 years, we've been working on a number of these projects, and they've all been in different places. As part of our practice is being located in Chicago, it's a good place. It's a good airline hub, and so we can go around and work in a lot of these different markets. And people, I think one of the first challenges that we always run into is a little bit of education. Most cities don't have one of these buildings built in them yet when we go in and build one. And so people are definitely used to a consistent way of doing things. And I'll share a quick story about T3 Austin to kind of illustrate that. Our building is pretty short in Austin. It's only three stories. A lot of the other T3s are a little bit taller. But we have these apartments on it, and they're of a scale that typically those apartments would be stick framed. And a wood stick framed building, the city inspectors decided that they would just get their, you know, their residential inspectors out there that are used to inspecting all these low-rise residential projects. And they pulled the contractor aside and they said, hey, there's no fire blocking in your walls. So on stick frame buildings for residential, you have to put a block between the 2x4s periodically to make sure that there's not waste for the fire to spread through the walls. And that's what they were comparing to the project to. They weren't comparing it. So I think a lot of people compare, you know, just the scale of the timber with the columns and the beams and the panels and things like that. They compare it to concrete. But these guys, because it's wood and because they're the guys that inspect wood buildings, and the typical wood building is one that's made out of studs, and there's a lot of requirements with framing with studs, they were trying to apply all those light wood framing requirements onto our project. And we had to clarify. We said, no, because we're, you know, this type of building, a type 4 building and not a type 5 building. And we have big pieces of wood and not little pieces of wood, that these requirements that you're trying to apply to our project, they don't apply. And so there's a bit of that. And the way that we try to mitigate that is we usually try to meet with the cities early on in the project before we go into permit, and we say, hey, this is the kind of building that we want to build. You know, what's your familiarity with this? Is there anything that you want us to help you understand better and just kind of present things to them and go over kind of the code justifications for the buildings and different things that we've run into ourselves and make sure that we both understand the code the same way. And if we do that, then once we get into permitting, you know, we can head off a lot of questions and for partners in the project, that really goes a long way. So educating the city inspectors, educating contractors, educating the permitting people, that has been a challenge over the last 10 years. It hopefully isn't so much in the next 10 years, but it was definitely part of what we did. A few other issues that are happening that lots of people are working on, you know, on projects like this, we depend a lot on outside testing to verify safety performance. One organization that is predominantly used is UL, and there's lots of different scenarios of materials coming together and things going through those materials where you need a UL listing. And there's not nearly as many UL listings for timber assemblies as there are for conventional construction. And so that's another challenge, is how you figure out how to make sure that everybody's comfortable with how the fire protection is going to work on the building. And so we work through that. And another issue is acoustics. Similarly with the UL listings, everybody relies on standard assemblies for sound separation ratings, SDC ratings. And that the industry has made a lot of strides on in the last just 3 or 4 years. And there's a lot of information out there. A few manufacturers have really jumped onto that and are providing good solutions. And then maybe the fourth big challenge I'd bring up is moisture protection and management. And that is involved in the construction process as well as the overall design. During construction, it's important to manage, because the structure gets erected a long time before it gets enclosed and it's going to be in the rain. And so you have to account for that, and you have to have a plan in advance of how do you keep the rain from making the timber look bad while it's, and that's really the biggest issue. Some people might say, oh, well, it's bad for wood to get wet. And yes, it is, but it takes a lot of wetting and drying cycles before the wood really gets to rot. The bigger issue is when it rains and it picks up a bunch of dirt and grit, and then it runs through the cracks and it runs down the face of your beautiful timber column that's going to be exposed, and, you know, preventing that as much as possible and then having ways to clean that up, and then also making sure that when the building's finished that there's good protection measures to make sure that the wood doesn't soak all the time. We have to make sure we design for drying whenever we're detailing the timber construction. You wouldn't want to trap water anywhere because that would cause long-term problems.
To meet sustainability goals, the team optimized the building envelope through strategically located glass and the introduction of vertical shades to manage solar gain and thermal efficiency.
One thing that we tried to do was to really optimize the building envelope. So we had a few priorities. We wanted to make sure that there were really good views. It's important in the office market to have, you know, nice views to the exterior. Comparable properties want to make sure that that is there. It's part of that perception as you walk out into those floors. We wanted to highlight the wood, as we mentioned, and we wanted to design a thermally efficient building. And having lots of glass and saving energy don't always align. And so we try to be judicious with the glass. And so along our north and west facades is where we ended up with a lot of glass. On the west facade, predominantly because we wanted to have some good views to the downtown, and on the north facade because, you know, we can get away with it. We don't have a lot of solar gain coming from the north. And in the way that we positioned and designed the building, you know, the office space kind of favors the north facade a bit. On the south facade, we took a little bit of a different approach. There's more of a punched opening approach instead of a long window wall. The west facade is one that normally you would want a lot of protection on. The afternoon sun, as it comes around the building and temperatures are high outside, it kind of exacerbates the solar gain because it's in the late heat of the afternoon that you're getting even more heat from the sun going in there. And so we wanted to maintain views. We wanted to help preserve that glass and the energy efficiency. And so we went through an extensive effort to design an optimal shading strategy. So along that west facade, we have these long vertical solar shades that are spaced every 5 feet along the facade that cut down on the majority of that low angle sun in the afternoon. And that process, we worked really hard to really optimize. We ran a script to determine, you know, the different metrics that we could use to see how successful those were. So on those shades, you know, you could do a lot of short shades tightly spaced. You could do long shades widely spaced, and they'd have similar energy efficiency measures, but they'd have different impacts to the perception and to the views. And so using a little bit of parametric design, we optimized that to where we were providing the energy efficiency that we needed, but we were still allowing for those views to go out to the downtown. And the end of it looked really nice. I thought that was one of the successful parts of the project. So in addition to optimizing the facade like that, the project is also pursuing LEED Gold certification. And so all of the typical ways of achieving that, including water conservation, stormwater management, and indoor air quality and materials, we pursued, as well as making sure the building is prepped so that any tenants who move in the future could achieve WELL certification on their spaces.
After successfully navigating the design and approval process, the team encountered another challenge during construction. Complications with utility companies and power lines threatened significant delays to the construction schedule.
One challenge that we ran into is after the project was bid and it was awarded to the contractor, they were doing all their due diligences and setting up the schedule and going to the city and making sure that they had everything planned in terms of the utilities and the connections and the street closings and things like that. And one thing that we found out is that because of all the construction that's happening in Austin right now, the utility companies are running really far behind. And there were some existing power lines along the west side of the building that were pretty unsightly. And we always planned to take down. And also, you can't work within a certain distance of those power lines. You have to be at least 15 feet away, or you have to get the power company to come and put sleeves on the electrical wires to make sure that nobody touches them and gets shocked or anything like that. And so we needed to have a crane come and set our shoring for our three-story below-grade parking garage. And that crane couldn't get within 15 feet of that utility line for the power line. And the utility company wasn't going to be able to get out and move those lines until like 9 months after we needed them to. And so we huddled together and we had to do a redesign of our parking garage and our foundations. Because we determined that, because it takes a long time to build a basement. We determined that if we could get the basement done, that by the time they got the basement done, they could get the utility lines, the power lines out of the way in time to build the upper three floors and keep the project schedule. So what we ended up doing is we brought in that west foundation wall 15 feet. And then we created some grade beams that came out and cantilevered past the edge of that foundation wall to pick up those columns on the west facade, because we wanted to keep the building all the way out to maintain that straight front and to not lose all that area. And so it was a pretty significant redesign effort that we worked together on with the contractor and with the client to make sure that we were still meeting everybody's needs with that, but we were able to avoid that huge delay by thinking outside of the box a little bit and restructuring our building.
After navigating this ambitious project, I was curious what Bobby's favorite and most memorable spaces were.
I think my favorite spot is the little spot just adjacent to the lobby. It's a little conference room. It's a little flex space. And it's just really nice. We designed these really interesting centrally pivoting doors. There's three of them, and they open up. It's just a really fun moment as you walk into the building, and there's the reception desk in front of you, and then off to the left is there's this nice little room, and it's got these fun doors, and the finish on them is wood, and so you spin all three of them and it encloses it, and it's kind of a nice secluded spot, and they've got a little cane bolt that you lift up and set. as you want to get in and out of them, but they're really fun. But I think one of the more interesting spaces and features of the building is the main circulation stair at the end of the lobby. And that has kind of an interesting story to it. So as we were trying to configure the building on the site, so there's apartments and there's office buildings, and usually you don't mix them together, or if you do, you put one on top of the other. But the way that we were configuring the site, we ended up putting them next to each other. So there's three stories of apartments next to three stories of office. And in that configuration, normally you'd have to have four stairs, two stairs for the apartment building and two stairs for the office building. But what we did is as we were exploring the most efficient ways to, you know, add area to the site, we positioned it so that the apartments and the office space share a stair in the middle. So they share the one stair, and then they have the stair at the other end, and the stair in the middle has doors that open from each use, and so they get the appropriate means of egress. And that was really interesting. And we designed it in a way so that the doors could be fail safe, which means that they're locked until there's a fire alarm. And so you don't necessarily have people who live in the apartments just able to wander out into the office building or things like that. But because of that configuration, Heinz, I think, is exploring some ideas of like potentially offering the apartments as an amenity to the office space. Like if a full building tenant came in, then maybe they would consider like using the office, the little apartments, as housing for their employees or something. It was a really unique thing that happened. But we spent a lot of time designing that stair, given that it's so short that you can rely solely on the stair to get up and down the building. So the elevators is pretty comfortable to walk up a few flights. And so we designed a pretty beautiful stair out of steel and timber. It has a skylight on the top. And so the light comes down from the top, and it highlights this feature brick wall that has this really interesting pattern. And that design of that stair, along with the function of it, was a really fun design problem to work through, and one that turned out really well.
DLR Group and Heinz have accumulated ample experience with T3 building projects, refining processes from design to construction. T3 Austin presented unique challenges and valuable lessons learned, particularly concerning solar sun shading implementation.
This wasn't our first project that we'd done with this client, with Heinz, and we had kind of gotten into a consistent rhythm of like, this is what they like. And so if we want to save ourselves some heartache, we give them what they like and we can all be a little bit better at it. But I was telling the story about these sunshades, and that was something that was a little bit challenging for us and a little bit challenging for them as well. So it's really hard to justify solar sun shading on projects. And the reason for that is because you can get similar benefits by tinting your glass. So you put a solar sunshade on the project, it cuts back, you know, 70% of the solar heat gain or something like that. Well, you tint your glass and you get a similar effect, and that's a much cheaper way of doing it. But we invested some significant effort to justify those solar sunshades. We did all this analysis. We talked about the views. We talked about the importance of seeing the timber through the glass. And if you had tinted the glass, that wouldn't be as visible. And that was a really important part of our concept. And if we hadn't invested that effort, then I really don't think that would have ever happened. But it's because we spent the time to really, you know, do our homework on it, it stayed in the project. And I think it is a unique part of the building, which provides a, you know, something that differentiates that west facade, which is the first one that you see as you approach the building from the downtown. And I was really happy about the result of that. And it taught me that as long as you're willing to work for it, if there's something that you see that you think would be worthwhile, that you can get people convinced to do it too.
DLR Group has amassed extensive experience with designing T3 buildings utilizing mass timber, which begged the question, what advice would Bobby give to another architect taking on their first mass timber project?
We're a big firm, and we get asked to kind of advise on projects all the time of like, oh, we're thinking about going mass timber on this project. What do you think? Do you think it's a good idea? We're going to study it against concrete or something like that. And anytime that you start down the path of we're going to design a concrete building and we're going to have timber as an alternate and we're going to price them, and if it looks appropriate, based off of the price, then we'll take timber. Anytime that happens, it never is successful. And early pricing structures just don't take into account the advantages that are possible from getting timber. And the design process for designing a timber building is a little bit different than designing a concrete building. And so if you really think that timber is the right fit for your project, then you need to make the case for it early on. You need to justify it in some way, and you need to make that decision and not keep it as an alternate, but keep it as what you're going to do. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to justify it, and it really doesn't make sense for every project. But when it does, if you can, you know, take that step from the beginning, I think at some point you can have faith that it really will work out for the best.
As the latest iteration of Hines Mass Timber Design, the T3 ATX Eastside is a model for future developments across North America. With its completion in November of 2023, it not only offers 92,000 square feet of Class A timber office space, but also debuts 15 corporate residential suites, a first for the T3 concept. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insights from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Bobby thought about how architectural firms can do a better job staying up to speed and not getting stuck in the "I have always done it this way" mindset.
I really think that the availability of information is sometimes a trap. So it seems like you can go on the internet and you can find most of what you might ever need about certain things. But in just going on the internet and looking for stuff, you're missing out on a significant amount of help and advice that you can get. And I think it's extremely important as architects that we maintain good relationships with manufacturer representatives. And as architects, we're expected to know everything, even though we don't. And there have been a lot of times where I've been able to call somebody and talk to them about something and gotten real solid technical advice on how to do something, advice that I can have confidence in because it's coming from the people who make something that doesn't exist online. And there's certain manufacturers that will help you design things. So the sunshades that we did on the West Facade, we had this vision for how they should look and how they should work, but we didn't necessarily design everything about them. We contacted a provider, a manufacturer. We said, "Hey, what can you do? What can you help us with?" And they had a whole design assist. And they said, "Well, you need to have these connections. You if you use this type of metal, it'll span this high," and all kinds of stuff like that. And so maintaining those relationships is really essential to allowing yourself flexibility and new opportunities with new materials and new products and new processes.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Bobby. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
So my impact that I'm looking forward is I think architects, sometimes we get in this trap of trying to solve all the world's problems with one building. I think that there's a lot of issues in the world that are caused by our cities and the way the buildings are designed, but I think it's a little too aspirational for us to think that my project is going to be the one that fixes everything. And so, you know, I really like making beautiful things, and I really hope that, you know, people will find joy in some of the things I leave behind. And I hope to do so in a way that I don't impact the world in a negative way by doing so. So I don't think I can solve all the world's problems, but I think I can try to make sure they don't get worse.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.